to your edition of Money Matters. Thanks for joining me today. And before we begin, don't forget the views expressed are my opinions only. Discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. I am an investment advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors, Incorporated. A registered investment advisor, indices mentioned are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. Investing involves risk. Depending on the types of investments, there may be varying degrees of risk. Investors should be prepared to bear loss, including total loss of principal. And remember, the views expressed are my opinions only. They do not necessarily reflect those of Cambridge, the station, and staff members or underwriters. Today, welcome to the 282nd show. Spring into 2019. Boy, the years are just clicking by, huh? This show is about money. Money does matter, and matters of money affect us all in some way or another. Whether you have a lot of it, a little of it, or none of it, it controls our economy, our country, our planet, in some way or another. Controls the very way we live our lives. It's about your money, your lack of it, or abundance of it. It's about our lives and livelihood. In short, Money Matters is about you. Okay, so we're live on Facebook today. I thought it'd kind of be interesting to just go live on my page. So hopefully if the phone doesn't fall down, you can watch us do the show. Okay, so as starting of every show, we always talk about these large numbers. 25,089, the Dow, the most watched index, down 300. And all-time high, 26,919 on the Dow. And recent low around 21,500, somewhere in there. Recent low, of course. Original low at zero. I don't know where the Dow actually started out when they opened it up years and years ago. But it now is sitting at 25,103 now. We've always talked about these large numbers, 25,000, 26,000, 24,000, 27,000. There are minor technical and major technical support and resistant levels. So if we're looking at 25,103, 25,000 below us would be a support level. And above us would be the 26,000 number as a resistance level. What that means is a lot of technical analysts will say that those numbers are hard to penetrate, both down and up. Down, going down underneath 25,000 would be going through support. And going up through 26,000 would be going through resistance. Now, there are a lot of other minor and major technical areas on the chart and numbers that the analysts look at. But the big ones, everybody pretty much agrees that these can be a technical support and resistance levels. Now, keep in mind that no theory, no prognostication about any where the markets will go is 100% accurate. Are some better than the others? Some say they are. But the technical resistance points underneath 25,000 support levels underneath us. So we'll see if that holds. Dow down 286. Don't know why it's going down today. Of course, there's many theories and other things that would indicate why it might go that way. But we'll see. So we'll talk about it. And so, it's interesting. One of the things that I've kind of noticed, you know, for years, the deficit was always in contention. It was always talked about. It was a big thing with the grand old party, the Republicans, to rein in the deficits. And it is commonly thought that the left side of the aisle, the Democrats want to spend more. I don't know if that's necessarily true. I think everybody's concerned about the deficit. But the talk about the deficit has pretty much disappeared. Although reining in the deficit is all but vanished from government speak nowadays, the problem is still a problem. With the first trillion in U.S. debt taking somewhere between 220 years to amass, in other words, from 1776 all the way up to about 1990, somewhere in there. It took all those years, 220 years, 225 years, to build up the United States owing $1 trillion. The first $1 trillion taking about 220 years, 225 to amass. Now, interestingly enough, like an overspending spouse on a credit card, we run up that amount more each year. So we used to, took 2.25 centuries to run up the first trillion. And now we're doing $1 trillion a year. Well, that goes along with exponential, spending on a credit card. If you spend on a credit card, the balances go higher and higher because of the deficit. So talk about an overspending family member. From the lips of Dick Cheney in 2003, of course, came the infamous quote, and now apparently common belief in Washington, Reagan proved that deficits don't matter, unquote, from Dick Cheney, 2003. Well, deficits matter in my house, and I bet you a dime to $1 trillion they will matter at some point to the United States, and I bet deficits matter to your house. In other words, all is well until it isn't. The debate about the deficit, we don't even hear about anymore, really, at least on most major news outlets, which I kind of watch. And what once was a GOP political go-to hot button, they've always, you know, hammered the left side of the aisle on the deficit. It's rarely debated anymore. Both sides now are just spending like crazy. But the debate on a deficit is still valid, at least in the mind of myself. I will just tell you that when they print money, if you look on your dollar bill, it says note, Federal Reserve note. Now, it used to be a certificate. You could take it to the bank and get a piece of silver or gold for it. When a certificate's a receipt. You take your saw into a saw shop and they give you a receipt. I have one saw. They don't give you a note. I owe you the equivalent amount. No, they give you a receipt. I actually have that in my saw shop. So nowadays when you look on the dollar, it says note. That's an IOU. Look it up. Note is an IOU. It's a note from the Federal Reserve. And if it's an IOU from the Federal Reserve, if you take that note to the Federal Reserve and say, I want to cash in this IOU, they won't give you anything except another note. So it's basically a IOU from a company that does nothing but make IOUs. Federal Reserve is owned, controlled by the major banks in the United States. So that there kind of has to, you know, give you a moment to pause to think about that. And the head of the Federal Reserve, the Federal Reserve chief, is appointed by the president, whoever that may be. So it's interesting. It's always a prudent decision to at least listen to an argument that might have dire consequences for the country and indeed the world. Historically, deficits have been the death knell of many civilizations through history. I've always said, you know, the bird flu or an atomic strike or a tsunami, you know, won't destroy a nation. Just look at Japan. I mean, they were two cities were bombed into oblivion. And they recovered fine. But economic problems have caused civilizations to collapse. Rome, I always thought it was 1,000 years, but I looked it up. It's 507 years that Rome existed. It eventually fell for a few reasons, of course, but one of them is being the degradation of its currency. In other words, they debased its currency. They were legal tender coins. You know, didn't resemble like ours, but they were coins. Everybody knows what a coin is, right? And toward the end, the Roman coins, I think it was the denarius, if I remember right, there are different versions of it, it had very little precious metal in it. It started out with silver or gold, and then toward the end it had very little precious metal in it because precious metal costs money. That's why they call it precious. So I guess you could ask, is the United States immune to such catastrophic endings as is brought about by a severely abused currency? Or is it really different this time? Do deficits matter? Sadly, we are not immune, and no, it is not different this time. It may be going longer than most people thought. It's because the United States is such a large country. You know, if we had a small little country like Zimbabwe printing money like crazy, the end of the currency and the end of the civilization or the end of the economy, as we know, it takes place pretty quick. But usually the bigger the country or the bigger the influence on the global stage, the longer it takes. And indeed, the United States is the biggest dog on the block, and the dollars are used, petrodollars, United States dollars are used to trade oil, an agreement that the Saudis and the United States reached many decades ago. They say that, look, we'll agree that oil has to be traded in U.S. dollars, and the United States says we'll protect the Saudis in response to that militarily. So, no, we are not immune, and it is not different. Few are more qualified to weigh in on the debate about deficits than former U.S. Comptroller General David Walker. Now, if you don't know what a Comptroller General does, from Wikipedia, the Comptroller General of the United States is the director of the Government Accountability Office, the GAO, formerly known as the General Accounting Office. That's a legislative branch agency established by Congress in 1921 to ensure the fiscal and managerial accountability of the federal government. In other words, they're the bookkeepers. They're making sure that the books are kept right. Sounds like Mr. David Walker would know because he held the office from 1998 to 2008. And I did have the pleasure of interviewing him shortly after he left office. It's funny, I tried to get an interview with Mr. David Walker while he was in the office. I mean, this guy sits at the big table, you know, a couple of chairs down from the president and all the people that are in there when they meet. And it was very hard to get an interview with him. And then he quit. He just stepped down, and I went, oh, no. But then I thought, well, maybe he'll talk now. And indeed, he did. I have that interview. I think I did it in 08. Is that when he left? Yeah, he left in 08. So I think I did the interview in 08 or 09. And in a Washington Times column, a recent column written by him, Putting America's Finances in Order, he states, quote, "It is abundantly clear that neither of the two major U.S. parties, Democrats, Republican, is fiscally responsible. Republicans focus on tax cuts, while Democrats focus on spending," so says Mr. Walker. "And neither party focuses on the bottom line or long-term finances." So let's get this straight. The two main political parties that run our country are not fiscally responsible, according to Mr. Walker. Given that the U.S. is the largest economy on the planet, that it might be being run by fiscally irresponsible people doesn't sound like such a good plan, neither for the U.S. nor for the entire globe, for that matter, because we have so much influence over the globe. The Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, and they look at the budget and spending and what programs are going to be viable, projects that the federal government will eventually reach the cut up the credit card moment, my term for it there, in about a decade. In other words, what they're saying is that the U.S. will be spending more on interest payments than national defense. Now, we all know, I believe the national defense budget is, I don't know, $600, $700, $800 billion. We'll be spending almost $1 trillion on interest. A mild ouch might be in order here. For those not willing to do the advanced math, let's put it in plain English. A big chunk of our income, the United States income from all the products and goods and services sold in the United States, will go to nothing productive. Basically, you might as well pile up the cash and burn it, as interest payments are basically money poured down the proverbial rat hole. Many of you will think the government has never had a problem before. The United States has never had a problem before. Well, they've actually defaulted 6 or 7 times. I won't go through each time that they've done that. The United States government has defaulted. You can Google that one up. But for the most part, the average American would think that the U.S. government has never had a problem before. True. At least not on the surface. But things are fine until they aren't fine, right? Others will say the government will just print the money. True again. But remember, when they print money, they're printing more notes. Those are IOUs, and there's a number on there. And so every time they print money, it adds to the deficit. Borrowing costs, if they borrow the money, that just creates more interest payments. However, if they print the money, you know, when they print the money, they will usually go to the government, buy treasuries with it, and then that money goes to the government, and then they can turn around and spend it. But that is logged as a debt. Others will say the government will borrow or print, but either way, it creates a deficit. So I would ask, will printing money save us? Doubtful, but let me retract that. No, printing money doesn't solve anything. Why? Well, let's think of what money is, really. Money is just colored paper with pictures of dead presidents on it. Really durable colored paper, but paper is the key word here. Not many will be able to comprehend why money doesn't solve anything, right? I could say, why does money not solve anything when you print it? And people will say, I don't know. Some people might be astute enough to tell me. Indeed, the U.S. government thinks that printing money solves something. If they didn't think it solved anything, they wouldn't do it. And they do it. And they do a lot of it. So they must just think printing lots of paper solves something. So I'll break it down to you pretty simple. Like, if printing money solves economic problems, why does the U.S. and other nations, too numerous to count, still have economic problems? Like I said, you don't need advanced math skills to see that one coming. We'll be right back on KVMR FM and your community radio station to continue the show. And you're tuned to Money Matters on your community radio station. We're live on Facebook. Yes, we still are. Till my phone runs out of batteries. That's if you're listening to the show live at 12:24 Pacific Standard Time on Thursday, February 7th. The show was carried on, I don't know, 4 or 5 dozen radio stations that air it at different times. So if you are not listening to it live during that time, 12:24 Pacific Standard Time on Thursday, February 7th, you can't call in. But you can call in now if you like, 530-265-9555. 530-265-9555. Okay. So anyway, I'm looking at an interesting article from Yahoo Finance. And, you know, I've put out a lot of motivational tapes, not that I've done, but I listen to motivational tapes, things of what makes people successful. Seems like, you know, making money nowadays can be a bad thing. At least some people believe that it's a bad thing, or making too much of it. So that would be debatable. But from an article from Yahoo Finance, people wonder what makes somebody successful or have a lot of money. And from Business Insider, Hillary Hofauer on Yahoo Finance today, the article is entitled, "A Woman Who Studied 600 Millionaires Found How Rich You Can Get Boils Down to 6 Things No Matter Your Age or Salary." So I think that's worth taking a look at. So she found 6 behaviors which she called the wealth factors, which were related to net worth potential and regardless of age and income. So that's good news, no matter what your age or your income. If you perform some of these things, or at least have these characteristics, maybe it'll increase your odds. So out of 600 millionaires, she studied a group of individuals from basically a net worth ranging from 100,000 to 1 million. And then studied a group of high and ultra-high net worth individuals, the 1%ers. 1, frugality, or a commitment to saving, spending less, and sticking to a budget. Frugal, right? That makes sense. As an advisor, I see people with money, some money, lots of money, and most of them are frugal. They don't spend a lot, or at least they're careful in how they spend. Confidence. They have confidence in financial management, investing, and household leadership. That probably goes hand in hand with experience, I would imagine. If you're confident, you've probably had experience in whatever you're confident in. If you don't know anything about something, I would imagine that the confidence would probably be a little bit lower on the scale. Responsibility, which involves accepting your role in financial outcomes and believing that luck plays a little role. Well, I always say that good luck is a result of preparation meeting opportunity. So those that apparently under the 600 people that she's studied, from 100,000 to 1 million to ultra-high income rollers, believe that you should accept your role in financial outcomes and that luck plays a little role in it. Although we know that luck does play some role in it. If you were born into a big, rich family, that's kind of the DNA draw, right? Focus. This one's important to me. I've seen this a lot. Focus on seeing tasks through to their completion without being distracted. I'm kind of a multitasking type of guy. I'll have 5 things open on my computer at one time. I'm able to talk on the phone and do work. And so I do have a lot of stuff. I'll start like 10 things in the morning and I'll just kind of, you know, finish one and finish the other. And I don't just, you know, have one task and finish it and go on to the next. When I need to do that, if I get up on a Saturday and I have a lot to do, I pop up early. I usually give my kids a chore list every Saturday and Sunday. They have to do chores and contribute to the household. They'll have to chop wood and mop the floor and vacuum my room or vacuum their room. So they'll get a chore list. And on occasion, when I have a lot to do, I'll make a list for myself in the morning. And my lists are usually anywhere from 20 to 35 things that I need to do. And they'll vary from get a newscast done, write an article, post a radio show, post some news, call somebody, look at investments, look at stocks, set up some tradings for the following week for clients, prepare for a seminar, or it could be, you know, weed the garden or, you know, cover the plants for a freeze. It has a lot of stuff. And that does focus me on what I need to do, because a lot of times if I don't make a list, I'll forget, you know, oh, I forgot to do that. And so usually as I go down this list, it'll be 20 or 30 things and it'll look daunting. But it does focus me, because then I'll focus on one thing on the list, write an article. So I'll sit down and I'll pen an article and then I can cross it off the list. And when I cross it off, it kind of gives me a sense of satisfaction, a sense of accomplishment that I've actually done that. And I find out when I do make a list, I get more things done. It's because I don't you know, start something and then go get a cup of coffee and go outside and pet the cat or cut my toenails. You know, I just want to get through the list and get it done. And usually at the end of the day, if I've gotten through almost everything, I feel pretty darn good. So focus. Focus on seeing tasks through to the completion without being distracted. I do get distracted, so a list does help me get those things done. Social indifference or not succumbing to social pressure to buy the latest thing. That probably is, well, everybody's got the hottest car, everybody's got the latest in clothing, or the biggest house or whatever, and I have really never been that way. I am socially indifferent as far as goes hand in hand with frugality. You know, I've never owned a new car, never. I can buy any car I want, and I've never owned one. Now, I bought the wife many new cars, because what do they say? Happy wife, happy life. But I've never bought a new car, and the reason being is I spent too much time at my local food banks, and had a friend of mine who bought a $230,000 Porsche, brand new. And you drive it off a lot, and it depreciates 20% immediately. So he bought a $230,000 Porsche or whatever I just said, and then that he drives off a lot, and it's worth $200,000. So I think of $30,000 that he lost for wanting to own a new car, and how many people that could feed. I mean, food banks are very efficient at taking a few dollars and feeding a lot of people with it. So when you think it, you know, when I do a Turkey Matters, which raises money for turkeys, turkeys used to be $7, so at $7 you could buy a turkey and then feed a family of four. Now I think we pay for $15, $16 for those turkeys. But divide 30,000 by, you know, $16 and see how many turkeys you could buy. And then multiply that by four, because a turkey will easily feed a family of four and probably more than once. And so $30,000, you know, would feed, I don't know, divided by 16, whatever that is. So that's the way I look at it. When I buy a car, of course, I've got kind of a neat way to buy a car. You can always email me, or when I give a seminar, sometimes I'll touch on that. I got a good way to buy a car. I usually buy a car that's a year old. So if I see a car that I want, and I don't buy new cars very often. I buy a new car maybe every eight, 9 years. Not very often. I will go and look for a car that's a year old. So let the other guy get the depreciation. Because if you buy a car that's got 20,000 miles on it, 25,000 miles cars, and you look it over, they're brand new. You know, I don't want to buy a car that anybody smoked in or ripped the seat. I'll buy a car that, you know, is a year old and save the money there. And so social indifference. So there you go. Now, on the opposite side of making a lot of money, and it has been, you know, it has been more discussed recently, is socialism. Now, I live in Nevada County, and it is, at least in my opinion, a left-leaning county. And I see a lot, you know, I'm on social media a lot, not so much spending time reading it, but posting, because, you know, I'm a public figure, and I want the advertising out there for the people to read the articles and the radio show, and I'm a financial advisor, so I'll look for customers that way. So I am on media a lot, posting. And as a result, my news feeds, I have access to 40 or 50 Facebook sites. I don't use Instagram, Facebook sites. And I see a lot of news feeds. And a lot of it is, of course, anti-Trump hate stuff. That's normal, at least in this county. I don't know if it would be in Idaho, but here it is. And a lot of talk about socialism. And socialism has gained ground. Some say that Bernie Sanders was a socialist, or that new woman, Ocasio, she's really young, been in Congress in about a month. And so, you know, there's been more accusations that many people on the right are socialists. And I don't know if many people on the left, there you go, I get confused, are socialists. And I will tell you that, in my opinion, I think that the conversation, at least from socialism, about wanting to go that way, has risen. So from a gentleman about a century ago, Alexander Fraser Tytler, kind of nailed it on the progression of societies. And I think many of you have seen this cycle of failure that is often referred to, from bondage to spiritual faith. And this is the progression of societies, from bondage to spiritual faith, from spiritual faith to great courage, from courage to liberty, from liberty to abundance, from abundance to complacency, from complacency to apathy, from apathy to dependence, and from dependence back into dependence back into bondage. So if you ask me where we were on this cycle, I think we've gone from complacency to apathy, and from apathy to somewhere independence. At least there are, you know, many more that are now dependent. And of course, the next step would be from dependence back into bondage. So from Alexander Fraser Tytler, quote, a democracy is always temporary in nature. A democracy is always temporary in nature. It simply cannot exist as a permanent form of government. A democracy will continue to exist up until the time that voters discover they can vote themselves generous gifts from the public treasury. From that moment on, the majority always votes for candidates who promise the most benefits from the public treasury, with the result that every democracy will finally collapse due to loose fiscal policy, which is always followed by a dictatorship. So, I would imagine, I know that you anti-Trump haters out there would probably say dictatorship equal Trump. But I would say that also, you know, loose fiscal policy toward the end of this cycle here is what we're seeing, right? I mean, I started out the show by saying we have $1 trillion deficits every year. That's pretty loose fiscal policy, if you ask me. Tytler is stating here that eventually a democratic system will fail because the populace will always vote in the majority's best interest being the key word here, as in how much money can I get somebody to give me? The reason the failure of democracy is predetermined is because of monetary inflation or monetary printing. Now, this is my theory, this part of it. Democracy, and this has a little bit to go along with what he said, loose fiscal policy. By inflating the money supply, and this is key, you know, I almost entitled the show Money Printing instead of Money Matters, because that really encompasses much of the problems that we see. From the living wage debate to minimum wages complete always being increased, to the workers being, you know, railed. Money printing has a lot to do with this. And because I'm schooled in economics, I got a degree in economics with honors in 1979. And that's basically all I read. Once I was in college and once I read The Brothers Karamazov and Plato's Republic, I never read another book. I have read other economic books, but... and I did read a World War II book about submarines. I'm kind of interested in those. But so my belief, people will try to polarize my belief into a political one. And my belief is not a political one. I'm an economic conservative because I believe in conservative economics. That's the Austrian school of economics. The other side is the Keynesian theory by John Maynard Keynes. And that's what basically the left side will go on, but Keynesianism really isn't even run the way it's supposed to be run. So the reason the failure of democracy is predetermined because monetary inflation and money printing. By inflating the money supply, printing money, right, printing those little dollars that say U.S. Federal Reserve note, the prices of most, if not all things, will rise eventually in the price of whatever currency is being printed in the nation that is doing it. So if you have Mexico printing a lot of pesos, prices will rise in pesos. Now, they may not necessarily rise in Swiss francs or U.S. dollars, but in the country where they're printing pesos, if they print a lot of them, and you've seen that, you know, Mexican peso is probably pretty familiar with everyone. They know what that means. I want you to think U.S. dollars here in the United States, or the best analogy is the Mexican peso. Monetary inflation is caused by the authority of the currency. Basically, the government of whatever country is in question. There are other types of inflation, demand inflation, supply inflation. There are other types, but I'm talking about monetary inflation. This is printing money, those little dollar bills that we see. Inflation is not necessarily a bad thing, except for one economic truth. And this is the key here. You really have to understand this. Wages, what somebody is paid, always lag price increases. Okay? So if we see a lot of inflation, the last thing to inflate are wages, okay? This means the more inflation you have and the longer you have inflation, what I call the affordability gap will relentlessly widen. As prices rise, if you're on Facebook, I'm making a little chart here with my hands. As prices rise, wages don't keep up. So you get this increasing wedge with a increasing distance between wages and price increases. So it's like running a race with a car. You're running 5 miles an hour and the car is driving 20. So you start out and you're even. And then you run it for an hour and you're behind 15 miles, right? Because the car is going 20 miles an hour, you're running 5. But if you keep running the race, you get further and further behind. So now the car right, is prices of everything, and you running are wages. So the longer you run inflation, the further behind wages get. And with each decrease in the wage, the gap widens between overall prices and wages. More people that were kind of running on the surface economically, budget-wise, fall under the bus. They say, oh, I can't make it anymore, and they fall under. So the longer you run the race, the more people fall into the lower income. It basically drops people in income brackets, okay? Wages always lag price increases. This means the more inflation you have and the longer you have it, the affordability gap will increase. As prices rise, wages fall further and further behind. As the wage gap, affordability gap, continues to widen, more people fall under the bus. More people can't make it. And that means they have a harder and harder time making ends meet. The result is, now here's the key, another key. The result is, wealth is never destroyed like energy, okay? It doesn't just disappear, okay? It's consumed or it's transferred. So when you have more and more people going broke, because they can no longer afford to buy something, that purchasing power doesn't disappear. It goes somewhere else. And what happens is it goes to the top. So it forms like a pyramid. The longer you run inflation, the taller the pyramid gets. The more people will go into the lower income brackets, and their wealth gets concentrated right at the very top. And the longer you run inflation, the more wealth gets concentrated. So maybe 10% of the people have most of the money, and then it's 9, then it's 8. And the longer you run inflation, pretty soon it gets to what? The 1%ers that everybody complains about. The result is that wealth concentrates to fewer and fewer people over time, which is what we're seeing, right? Everybody says the super rich control, 2% of the country controls 50% of the wealth or whatever that figure is. If that wasn't bad enough, and that's horrendous, that people can't make a living. When I grew up, my bus driver, I had 4 kids that can afford to go to Disneyland and a doctor, and now you got 2 parents working with 1 kid, and you can barely make it, right? That's what's happening, is that affordability gap is widening. What makes it worse is that more people find it harder to pay their bills, the call for government assistance gets louder and louder, right? More poor people. We have to redistribute the wealth at the top and funnel it back down. Mechanically, not organically, mechanically. We have to take it from them and move it down below. What happens is that the calls for government assistance get louder and louder. This results in more and more candidates promising the most benefits. We're going to do health care. We're going to do, free schools or whatever they're asking for. And therefore, the results in the candidates promising the most benefits, they get elected, and those vying for a return to a sound economic model, stop the money printing, the cessation of printed money, get voted out. And that's what you're seeing. That's what Alexander Tytler Fraser said, is that if more and more people, we run inflation because the government keeps printing money. As more and more governments print money, the more they print, the more people fall under the bus, and the cries for social assistance get louder. Okay, so this results in more and more elected officials, right, towing the party line of ever-increasing government assistance, right? You're right. There are more poor people, and you're right. The wealth is concentrating at the top. So we need more assistance from the government to take the money from the top and redistribute it toward the bottom. However, when they do this, okay, they don't just take it from taxes and put it down at the bottom. They also print like heck, right? 220 years to manufacture the first trillion in debt. Now we're doing that every year. So that is monetary inflation. They're inflating the money supply. So the more and more elected officials towing the party line of ever-increasing government assistance, which in turn results in more money printing, because you could tax every rich person in the nation, and you still wouldn't fix all the problem. So it results in more money printing, which results in more inflation, which results in the gap continuing to widen, and more people need help until the amount of people that need help is the majority of people that vote. And because they don't quite understand that monetary inflation causes this, they're going to vote for government assistance. And that's what Alexander Tytler says. As soon as people find out they can vote their largesse from the public treasury, then you're kind of doomed. because you'll just see more inflation and more people fall under the bus. Now, this is even more interesting. And I want you to listen carefully to this. Because the cause and effect of monetary inflation is not widely understood, the very policies that the masses cry for, which is more public assistance, makes the situation worse down the line. Because if you print money to help people, and I'm not saying helping people is bad, I'm just talking about the economic math here, okay? When you print money to throw it out there, it causes more inflation and more people go broke. It's a vicious cycle and a deceptive one. Inflation is named as a stealth tax, and it is a very seductive stealth tax, because when we have more inflation, your stocks go up and your houses go up and your wages go up, but they don't keep up. And people say, well, I'm making more money. How come I can't keep up? Because they don't understand that wages always lag what prices do. The concentration of wealth at the top is also predicted by this model. Remember the pyramid. The more and more people go broke, the money goes to the top because wealth is essentially not destroyed. The concentration of wealth at the top is also predicted. And it's a natural byproduct of this process of monetary inflation, because wealth, in essence, is never destroyed. The decrease of wealth in the masses, which is decrease of purchasing power, okay? It's not necessarily they have less money. Indeed, they have more money than they did 10 years ago. But they talk about the nominal wages is how much you have. But the effective wages is how much you can spend and buy stuff. So your purchasing power is the key here. The concentration of wealth is predicted, and the wealth moves up food chain. I have more money, but I still can't buy as much as I did when I had less money. The more people who go broke, the more money moves up. And the result is the concentration of wealth goes into fewer and fewer people. Here's how inflation hurts the lower income bracket. And then I'll tell you the secret about the higher income bracket. What happens on a lower income bracket, okay? Imagine a family making $30,000 with no assets. Okay, we make $30,000 and I got to buy food and send my kids and buy clothes and braces. Okay, let's say that somebody with $30,000 with no savings, which are a lot of people, more than half the country, don't have anything. He sees 5%, or they see, or she sees 5% inflation. Okay, so they see their expense rise by 5%. 5% inflation, they've got 5% less purchasing power, and they were spending $30,000, and now they need to spend $36,000, which is 5% more, if I did my math right, or what is that? 10% would be $3,000, 5% would be $1,500 more. Okay, there we go. Advanced math's kind of tough for me. They lose $1,800 in buying power, or some $1,500, and have no way of making it up, right? I only make $30,000, but now I got to spend 5% more to buy the same thing I did yesterday. Okay, so you see inflation, it hurts the people that are running close to the surface monetarily. Now, here's how the wealth gets concentrated to the top, okay? Imagine an individual now has $30 million in assets. The other guy didn't have anything. He's got $30,000. He spends it every day. But a guy has $30 million, okay? Regardless of what he makes, let's just say he has $30 million in assets. He sees a 5% inflation rate. But because inflation inflates his assets, right? His net worth of his assets increase by 5%. 5% of 30 million, right? So when he sees 5% inflation, he becomes worth more because he has assets that inflate with the price of everything else, where the other person is just making wages and spending it. Whereas the family making $30,000 only finds it harder to pay their bills, the rich person has actually gotten a heck of a lot richer. Okay. Also, remember, his $6 million came from somewhere, right? He got $6 million or richer. Where did it come from? Well, it came from the loss of purchasing power from all those other families. So roughly a $6 million increase in this guy's wealth from 5% inflation pretty much wipes out 3,300 families. So while one guy gets richer, 3,000-something families go poor, get poor. That is a fast path through the concentration of wealth, and that's what we see. Monetary inflation to fund government spending, whatever it is, even in military spending, we spend a ton. We could wipe out the world three times over. Is that really necessary? This monetary inflation demanding more help will eventually devastate those in the lower income brackets. Those are the people that are the very ones that are calling for help. So in a weird way, the very thing that people are calling for that need help is going to make them worse off later. And because that bracket of people going broke will get wider and wider, they will eventually vote themselves the generous gifts referred to in Tytler's quote, and the cycle will progress. Put it another way, this is really key. The rich, super rich, love inflation because it makes them wealthier. The poor person doesn't like inflation. Low income, even now, middle income have a hard time making ends meet. I have people with $600,000-$800,000 as clients, and they are worried they don't have enough. I kid you not. That may sound ridiculous to people that don't have anything, but they're truly worried they don't have enough. They may be in the top 20% of the country, but they're still worried they don't have enough. And you do the math, they may not. Those voting for government assistance, I repeat, don't realize the very thing they think will help will just do more damage eventually to more people. As for the rich, you know, I mean, monetary inflation is also like a drug. It's addictive. Because if you stop using it, somebody comes in and says, okay, we're going to go back to a healthy economy. We're not going to overspend. We're not going to run a deficit anymore. To go back to an economic model of fiscal responsibility slams the gears in reverse. And we have gone so far down that road, even if they stop the growth of monetary inflation, let's say they went from $1 trillion to $500 billion, the pain felt because these assistance programs would be pulled back. Okay? Or even if you pull military spending back, people are going to lose their jobs. The pain felt by just reducing the amount that you go into deficit spending or the speed at which you do it would cause massive pain. We're that far down. We're that far addicted to the monetary drug called monetary inflation. Even to cut the rate of speed would be extremely painful, let alone actually going into a spend as you go. Spend, go spend, or whatever it is, where you spend only what you take in. And that sort of pain will be so for the very people that the first go around deficited, the poor. They'll suffer if we go to a balanced budget. And like a drug, we continually need more and more deficit spending, which is why we took 200-something years to spend $1 trillion. Now we're doing that a year. And I'm telling you, in 10 years, we'll be spending $2 trillion a year. We need more and more of it. And here's kind of an analogy, but I take a lot of rash of stuff when I use this analogy. Think minimum wage increases. How many times has it been raised? And here we go again. Well, the definition of insanity is trying something over and over and getting the same result. Well, minimum wage increases, we've had, I don't know, 20-something minimum wage increases. 29, I think, or 30. I got the number somewhere in here. Here we go again. You know, now they want to go to $15. I'm not saying that's bad or good. I'm just saying that fits the model. I had one guy that said on social media, he said, Mark, just raise it to $100 an hour and it'll solve the problem. Well, if you raise it to $100 an hour, you would see massive, massive inflation. It would help for a while, and then it would be worse than it was before you did it. As for the rich, the super rich, the guys up there that make the policy, they probably hope that the masses keep calling for more assistance through more government assistance because they love it. Don't expect the masses to understand this monetary puzzle, this advanced math. From Upton Sinclair, it is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it. It's a vicious cycle. So I will predict that those vying for a socialistic model, you're going to get your wish. It'll happen. I don't know how many years it'll happen, but it'll happen. And it'll happen more and more. It'll happen slowly. One day we just won't be a socialist country. It'll happen. And then those that don't believe in that will say, I told you so, if they're still alive. So, you know, I'm a firm believer that socialism doesn't work because socialism prescribes to this model of inflation. And most socialistic countries, I know a lot of people refer to the Nordic countries, they are semi-socialistic, but they have capitalism mixed in there. I know capitalism is a bad word to most of you, but capitalism is nothing more than you going to the supermarket and buying what you want to buy at the price you want to buy it at. That's all it is. All the S of this stuff, all the other stuff are just offshoots of it. But what you've seen, basically since FDR, is not true capitalism. It's lobby systems. How many of you hate the lobby systems? That's just a terrible system. Why do they even allow lobbyists to go around and lobby for stuff, you know, for more guns? And why do they do that? It's crazy. So I know that the socialistic candidates will get more and more power. I think that we will become more and more of a socialistic country. I don't think we'll become like, you know, the true socialistic countries. But I think that the manual distribution of wealth, mechanically plucking it from the rich and giving it to the poor, is going to cause more inflation. You have to have an organic fix like that. And the organic fix to that is we go to a balanced budget. But the pain that the poor would feel, middle income, lower income, even the higher income, would be devastating. Devastating. And nobody would put up with it. So you're going to get your wish. People that believe that, they're going to get their wish. And I probably won't be around to see it. Or I probably won't be around to see the result of it. I, myself, am firmly convinced in my mind what the result will be. But no, there are others that believe otherwise. And so, anyway, that's the progression of socialism. And we'll be right back to conclude the show. You're listening to Money Matters on your community radio station. And you're tuned to Money Matters on your community radio station, show number 282, spring into 2009. And you can get all past shows, most past shows, on moneymanagementradio.com. That's a free website. Everything is free. It's our way of a community radio station giving back to the community, saying that you can get all the information there, and it's no cost. Okay. Remember, show 282 is today, spring into 2019. Remember that discussions in this show should not be construed as individual investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. I'm an investment advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Indices mentioned are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. Investing involves risk. Depending on the types of investments, there are varying degrees of risk. Investors should be prepared to bear loss, including total loss of principal. The views expressed are my opinions only. They do not necessarily reflect those of this station, Cambridge, its staff members, or underwriters. God bless. Have a great day. Give back to your community. Community is you. You're the you in community, right? Okay. And I'll see you next time. Have a great day.